listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with novelist Carol Ann Shaw, whose new book is Carrie the One, published by Simon & Schuster. Carol is also the author of the novels Seven Moves, Aquamarine, and Lucky in the Corner. She has won the Carl Sandburg Society of Midland Authors and Farrow Grumley Awards for Fiction and has three times been a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award. Her short fiction has been anthologized and published in various periodicals, including VLS, New Ohio Review, and Tin House. Her stories, Hammam and Elvis Has Left the Building, were chosen for inclusion in Best American Short Stories of 1994 and 1998, respectively. Hammam was read on NPR's Selected Shorts series. Her latest story, The Last Speaker of the Language, will be included in Best American Short Stories 2012. Carol Ann Shaw is a past fellow of the Illinois Arts Council and the National Endowment for the Arts. She teaches in the MFA in Writing program at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. She also used to teach at the MFA in Writing program at Vermont College of Fine Arts. Carol Ann Shaw is also a painter. She lives in Chicago and Amsterdam with her partner, Jesse Ewing, and their dog, Tom. Carrie the One begins in the hours following Carmen's wedding reception, when a car filled with stoned, drunk, and sleepy guests accidentally hits and kills a girl on a dark country road. For the next 25 years, those involved, including Carmen and her brother and sister, craft their lives in response to this single tragic moment. As one character says, when you add us up, you always have to carry the one. Through friendships and love affairs, marriage and divorce, parenthood, holidays, and the modest calamities and tragedies of ordinary days, Carrie the One shows how one life affects another and how those who thrive and those who self-destruct are closer to each other than we'd expect. As they seek redemption through addiction, social justice, and art, Anshaw's characters reflect our deepest pain and longings, our joys, and our transcendent moments of understanding. Deceptively short and simple in its premise, this wise, wry, and erotically charged novel derives its power and appeal from the author's exquisite use of language, her sympathy for her recognizable, very flawed characters, and her persuasive belief in the transforming forces of time and love. I spoke to Carol Ann Shaw last week. When we spoke, I started out by asking her, as I often do, what inspired her to write this novel, but also if there was a single moment that triggered this for her, and how the novel came to be.
The book came together out of a lot of different pieces over a long period of time. I think the first impulse I had to write this book was on the L coming home one night, and you from downtown, and you pass the backs of thousands of apartments with these wood porches, and on a Friday night particularly, you see all the lights on and everybody's coming home, and I just thought, oh, the life that's packed into this city, and I've lived here a very long time, and how much there's just something about the vitality and the energy, and it's part of that is the compact nature of a city. And so I wanted to write a book that took place over a long period of time, but with the same characters living in Chicago. And I started writing stories about them. I got a couple stories in Best American that were about Carmen and Alice and sisters. And then, so how does this come together? Then my brother's addictions became very, very bad. And I asked him, I said, I'd like to write a character who's not you but has your addictions. Is that okay? And he said, yeah, sure. The more the stories get out there, the better. And so that's when I added the brother. And the circumstance of an accident and of killing someone and having to go on, I do know someone that happened to, but it wasn't so much that as I needed a linking event for all the characters, and I think that's how I came at it.
And it was such a great
bonding event for all of them. You know, I mean, bringing together people who probably would never have seen each other again after that day,
but would
even if they didn't see each other again, would think of each other because that event is so intense. So before we even get into the storyline, I wanted to just talk about your epigraph, which is great. And I was wondering, well, first of all, I'll just read it. Oh, the night came undone like a party dress and fell at her feet in a beautiful mess, which is from Barroom Girls. So I wanted to talk a little bit, too, about, like, the art of finding the perfect epigraph. Did that just – did you run across that and think, oh, that's perfect, or do you go looking for them?
No, I didn't go looking. I love Gillian Welsh and her music, and I don't know. I love that song, and it's one of two or three of, you know, my favorite songs of hers. And I thought, yeah, that would be perfect.
It was perfect. So the beginning of the book, that first chapter, is really. I enjoyed the way that it worked structurally because it's before the accident, which will kind of link these characters emotionally, and we get to see the characters in the before parts of their lives, but
the last before part,
yeah, and they're all together probably, you know, for one of the last times that they'll all be together before the accident.
Right.
So, can you talk about just sort of deciding that that's where you would begin?
Well. It was a very difficult chapter to write because I had to introduce every single character who was going to be important through the rest of the book. And I must have gone through 15 revisions of that just to make it clear, just so the reader wouldn't feel wandering or lost or misled. And it took me a long time to get it right. Just a long time, just so much... There's so much happening, and there's so much happening simultaneously, too. So I had to indicate that.
Yeah.
Little tricks to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the wedding is wonderful, too, because it's an event. It's an event in and of itself before the event that actually becomes more important, in a way.
Yeah, it's the kind of wedding that used to happen, as opposed to these... horrible, you know, three ring shows that are put on now. It was it was a wedding in a garden and an outdoor reception and a bad band and no chocolate fountain
and people dancing poorly and wandering off into rooms in the house.
It's an old fashioned wedding.
I wonder, before we talk anymore, maybe this would be a good time for you to read a little bit from Carrie the One, and then we can keep talking.
All right, I'm going to read a couple of pages that take place about midway through the book. And Alice, one of the sisters, is meeting her brother for dinner, and his addictions are pretty bad. He's picked himself up and fallen a number of times. And I think she thinks she's going to find him on the straight and narrow when she meets him for dinner at this Thai restaurant, but it turns out otherwise. So I'll just read you part of that section. It's called Pad Sayu. If Nick weren't Alice's brother, if he were just a friend, she supposed they would have drifted apart long ago. But they were not friends. They were here to keep each other from spinning off alone into the dark matter of the universe. They never said this aloud. Instead, they held small rituals, concocted ordinary traditions. They tried to seem like everyone else, like two people in a snapshot. For instance, the two of them had November birthdays a week and 3 years apart. Every year, they found a midpoint and treated each other to dinner. This year, Alice was turning 35, Nick 32. She suggested they meet at a Thai restaurant up on Broadway. They'd been there before. When Alice arrived, Nick was sitting alone by the door on one of two chairs provided for takeout customers. Although the windows were steamed over and it was about 90 degrees in the restaurant, he seemed quite comfortable in a heavy flannel shirt with a red quilted vest over it. Both looked as if they were from L.L. Bean. He enjoyed ordering from catalogs. He looked like he had just arrived from a logging camp. At the moment, he was fascinated by a little electric fountain near the entrance that ladled water out of and back into a synthetically steaming miniature wishing well. This piece of Asian bric-a-brac had been ladling and steaming through the two or three previous dinners they'd had here, so it fell into the category of peculiar but no longer remarkable. Alice took Nick's fascination as a bad sign. He was holding a thick, plastic-sleeved menu, the cover a collage of lurid color photos, which at first glance appeared to be underwater shots of amorphous sea creatures, but when you look closer, were snapshots of various curries and noodle dishes. These pictures are just so colorful. I'd really like to Xerox this for this woman who just moved into my building. She's a photographer. Nina. From this neighborly impulse, Alice understood that Nina was a woman with large breasts. Nick went on. Do you think they have a copier in the back there? Sure. Probably a color copier, Alice said. And a postal substation, like most storefront restaurants. He twisted in his seat to peer back toward the kitchen. Do you think it would be okay to ask them to make a copy? Alice said, I think we ought to just get a table and use the menu to order the meal we're going to eat here, you know, now. More bad signs cropped up when they were seated across from each other at a glass-topped table giving off a blue astringent smell. Alice noticed that Nick's eyes, usually a clear green, were currently crusty pinholes. His face had too much definition. The skin was stretched a little too tight over the bone and muscle beneath. She was reminded of faces in Lucian Freud's paintings. He seemed to be in a hurry, although when she asked if he had to be anywhere, he said no. As soon as they ordered, he popped off to the bathroom. Nick came back. He picked up his menu and scrutinized it for a long time. Whatever he'd loaded up on in the john was kicking in. He had pumped up from cold to hot, dropped from agitated to dreamy. He sat a while without speaking. When he finally said something, what he said was, coconut. Like this counted as conversation, or he had just taken conversation to some higher plane, where everything was encrypted and compressed, while Alice was still working the old-fashioned way, with sentences.
Thank you very much. That's Carol Anshaw reading from Carrie the One, which is published by Simon & Schuster. I love that section. Actually, I had a question set aside to ask you about.
Okay.
Well, in fact, it's not about that section specifically, but the first sentence of what you just read, if Nick weren't Alice's brother, if he were just a friend, she supposed they would have drifted apart long ago, but they were not friends. They were here to keep each other from spinning off alone into the dark matter of the universe. I love that those sentences, first of all. And I also loved the way that, and you do have a specific sentence in the book that explains the title, Carrie the One, but there are a number of moments in the book where we understand how interlinked these characters are and how they rely on each other, depend on each other. And that's one of them. That's one of those things, you know, they need to carry each other through
right.
in a way. So I just wanted to mention that. But the other thing I was going to ask you about is Nick's job is in astronomy, and I love the way that his role as an astronomer comes in. You know, they're keeping each other from spinning off alone into
right.
the dark matter of the universe. That's also good. So I guess I'm just telling you that instead of asking you a question, really. So.
Well, there was a lot more astronomy in the book. I had the first version I wrote of this book was 100 pages longer, and I had interstices, things that were about astronomy and about the universe. And then when I compressed the book, I took those out. So there's really much less astronomy than when I went in. But it gave me the privilege of reading a lot about astronomy, which is pretty mind-blowing. So,
yeah, I was going to ask you, because you offer enough information from his perspective about his work that it makes it sound sort of academically feasible without being dry. And I wondered, how hard is that to do? I mean, unless you have a lot of astronomy in your background, which it doesn't necessarily sound like you do.
No, but it's all fascinating.
Yeah. No, it is. It is. Yeah. But was it hard to pull out what you felt was extraneous, or was that easy to see?
I don't know. It was all in the service of tightening up the book. And I think that the outcome of doing the tightening, which is more than just removing those little sections, but a lot of other tightening, is to make a book that has a big sweep to it, but it's very compressed. And
right.
my hope is that the reader will feel that in a kind of delicious way, that mm-hmm. they're breezing along, you know, with the wind going through their hair, and they can feel the velocity, but it's not taking that long. So I just, that's the that was my effort in that direction.
Okay. Great. Another sibling is Carmen. Carmen and Alice and Nick are siblings.
Right.
And at one point you make the statement in the book, Carmen was very good at keeping people from their worst behavior. I thought that was great. And I thought it was just a wonderful way to kind of make the reader think about her before. I mean, it's pretty early in the book. And then we have this opportunity to sort of watch how Carmen behaves throughout the book. And it really turns out to be quite true a lot of the time. But it's also ironic because she didn't keep them from driving away after the wedding and getting into trouble in that way. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that characteristic of Carmen, that she's good at keeping people from their worst behavior.
Oh, she's kind of a roaming conscience. You know, that she pops up here and there to remind people what they should be doing instead of what they are doing, which makes her very admired, I think, and she pays a price too in the book for her ardor for what's right, but it also makes her a pain in the neck. You know, she's the one who's always pointing out your recycling feebleness or your ethical lapse, and so that it's a two-pronged feature.
Mm-hmm. And she's always kind of perfect. I mean, dressed just so.
Yeah,
and
she's very orderly.
Very orderly. But,
yes.
But, you know, despite that, I mean, whatever their rancor might be sometimes between, you know, siblings, the rapport is just wonderful always. I loved how you presented them as a unit.
Sometimes I create characters that I think are wish fulfillment. And I did that in Aquamarine. I had a character there, Hallie Butts, who was a kind of semi-parental figure. I think I always wanted somebody like her in my life. And I've always longed for a sister, and I don't have one. And so I made up kind of an idyllic sisterhood there. It's just my own wish fulfillment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what's fun about writing fiction. You can create a whole new world.
Yeah.
So one of the themes in the book has to do with character guilt and atonement. And it's so interesting to read the ways in which you present each of them as going through this process of dealing with the accident and sort of, you know, some of them really kind of punish themselves for the role that they played. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and then talk a little bit about Alice's paintings, which I think fit into this theme, sort of.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can't... What I felt I needed to do was to have the accident hover over them through the rest of their lives without turning them into those monks in Monty Python's Holy Grail where they would go around beating their heads with breadboards as they walk. You know, so that was the line I was trying. Although I've gotten comments from readers that they suffer too much, and other ones they don't suffer enough. And they think about her too much, the girl, and then they don't think about her, you know, in the way I would if I'd done it. You know, so everybody has their own. I just was doing the best I could on that. And they all have their own ways of dealing with it. They're not only guilty or only remorseful or whatever. Right. And Alice is a painter, a pretty good painter, and becomes a famous painter. And her way of coping with it is that she... paints paintings of the girl at successive ages going through the life that the accident stopped her from living. And Alice doesn't make these paintings up herself. She feels that she is given the painting even when she doesn't understand it, the setting, whatever, and it's really transcribing something. And kind of ironically, I guess they're her best paintings, and she won't show them ever. She knows she won't show them ever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. Which is a really interesting, I thought that was a really interesting thing to do for her character. I also just, this is related, I'm quite sure that the cover of your book, I think, is one of Alice's paintings, and the back cover of the book is the back side of a painting. Is that?
Well, actually, the back side of the book is the back of a canvas. I'm a painter myself, and they said I could paint the cover. They wanted to see what I would do, and I had a I had a whole different painting in mind. And then, and they liked it. I was really surprised. But then this thing came in, and it isn't really, I didn't even think of it. Isn't that funny? As a painting of her. It's a very hard book to pull into either a title or an illustration because it has so many threads. Yeah, I guess I didn't think of this as a painting.
Oh, you didn't think of the title of the cover as being one of Alice's paintings?
No, not at all.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I haven't heard anyone else say that either. And in the back, I wanted to be the back of the painting I had painted for the cover.
So the back of the book is the back of a canvas.
And, it is.
You know, it's framed and stapled, and I just love that. It was
cool, huh?
It made the book seem like an artistic piece apart from a book, which was cool. And you can't get that in the Kindle, but
right.
It's pretty cool.
No, I had the idea, and the art director had that same idea for the back of the book, but I don't know. They like this cover better, and I'm fine with it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I would love to see the painting you were going to use.
But, I'm saving that painting. You know, there might be
another one.
Well, there might be maybe Spain will buy it, and they won't have a cover in mind. So,
yeah. There you go. I wanted to ask you about character description. Physical character description. You know, in this book, by the time we actually see the character Alice through Nick's eyes, her brother's eyes, she's actually been in several scenes without a great deal of detailed description. And I found that really interesting. You know, I've been reading about Alice for a little while, and then there's the scene where Nick is describing her in his head, you know, or his narration is. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, is character description necessary all the time? And how soon is it necessary? If it
was,
is.
Was your idea of her very different?
No, not necessarily. I wasn't finding myself picturing her until that was given to me, and then I enjoyed that. But I hadn't pictured her very differently.
I have pretty clear ideas of how the characters look, and often when I'm starting out on a book, if I see somebody in a magazine or newspaper photo that I think resembles them, I clip it out and I paste it in a book folder so that I just kind of refer back. I have a picture of Alice. She's somebody in a newspaper photo. I don't remember who she is, but I'm very clear on what she looks like. So then I maybe try to paint it in, but only a little bit. A dab here, a dab there.
Right. Just the certain detail that will, you know, do more than just describing every little thing.
Yeah, and it's really fun to have other characters do that work for you. To not have to say, oh, Alice had brown hair, but rather to have her brother interpret how she looks to him for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, what about the whole timing of it? Were you aware that maybe this was a little later in the book? I mean, it seems like a lot of times a character is described the first time that they enter into the first scene that they're in. And I liked that wasn't the case in this, but I don't remember if I've seen that before.
Wow. I don't know. I didn't think of that. Mm-hmm. I didn't think of that.
Probably because we weren't in somebody else's point of view the first time she was in a scene, so she wouldn't sit there and describe herself. But
because the book rolls on, you have an idea how everybody looks. But I think that so I had a student in Vermont, actually, who said that he thought stories, and I think this, you know, goes for novels too, should be like rooms that the reader can walk into. You can beckon the reader into the room, and the reader can look around and see things, but that each reader might see these things a little differently, so that there's enough allowance for that. So, and that's one of the privileges I have. I don't have to write a movie and then Keira Knightley is going to, you know, play Alice, and that's it. That part of the job is taken away from me. You know, I mean, I have to really work at creating people in your mind, but your Alice is probably going to look a little bit different from my Alice.
Yeah, I like that. I like the idea that some of it's up to the reader, and it's not just sort of set in stone in some way.
I think books are the only thing that do that. When you think about it, visual art of any kind is a given. I mean, the painting is there, the movie is there, and so it's given to you kind of on a platter, but books are always, and this is just so amazing, they're just symbols on pieces of paper.
Yeah.
So that what happens between the writer and the book and the reader is a kind of compact that everybody's in on, to you put it out there and they take it out. You put it in, they take it out. And what they take out is often a little bit different, I think, from what you put in.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of your work at Vermont College, I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about your background. I know you taught in that program. Do you teach anywhere else?
I've been 15 years teaching in the MFA program at SAIC, which is the School of the Art Institute here in Chicago.
Okay. And you don't teach at Vermont College anymore?
Mm-mm, I don't. I did. I was a student there. And then I was a graduate assistant there, and then I was a teacher there. So I think, like, there should be a plaque for me. really, I've done every – I taught at the postgraduate conference. Yeah, no, I love that place.
And what else about your background? What else would you say as far as your writing experience? Were you writing a long time before you went to the program? Or?
Yeah, I was, actually. And I initially went there just so I could get a teaching credential. And I had Aquamarine all written. And by the time I started in the program, it had been sold to Houghton Mifflin. So my first project there was a revision of the novel, which I did with Sharon Stark. And I got kind of fast-tracked through the program because much of what they wanted me to do, for instance, they wanted to do a critical thesis, but I had just won the National Book Critics Circle Award for my essays in The Village Voice, so they let me count those.
No, that's great.
Yeah, because...
It seems fair.
Yeah, they didn't need to ask me to write a book report. So, although, actually, Diane Leffer made me write some book reports. She said she didn't care. She wanted me to do it. She didn't think I made enough eye contact during my graduate reading, but I still squeaked through and graduated.
That's so funny.
Yeah, I still make terrible eye contact. I try to avoid eye contact in any situation whenever possible.
Well, so how about readings? Do they make you uncomfortable?
No, they don't. They're kind of fun. And now they don't like you to drone on forever. Now when I go to a bookstore, I read a little and then I try to engage the audience with me and talking about the book. And that seems a lot livelier. And people have a lot of thoughts on things and it's fun to find out what they are.
Yeah, yeah. So, Carol, in a recent interview, you said of your parents, life under their rule was such a terrible experience, I haven't wanted to relive it by writing autobiographically. And I'm not going to ask you about your life under your parents for that very reason. But I am curious about what we do or do not write about and what is harder or easier. And I personally always do find it harder to write directly from personal experience than to kind of make something up. And I just wonder if we can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's easier for me to make stuff up, for sure. You know, my own lousy childhood was, not as bad as lots of people's. They're the ones who get to write the memoirs, the ones who had the, real nightmare childhoods. Mine was kind of, it was bad, but it wasn't, nobody was flogging me in a woodshed or anything like that. So
what do you think it is about personal experience? I mean, even if we want to draw attention and write about something beautiful, sometimes I even find that harder if I've experienced it than if I make it up. Is that true for you, or is
that
different?
Yeah, I think I would say that's true, yeah. Although, sometimes I'll be in the midst of something, like in that steam bath that's in the one chapter. I mean, when mm-hmm. I was there, I thought, if I don't write about this place, they're going to take my writer's card away from me, because it's just too good to pass up. So there are things like that, and I try to, but I never keep a notebook. I used to years and years ago when I started, and then anything I ever used from the notebook sounded like something from a notebook.
Right,
sounded
right.
Kind of rammed in and then, cemented over, and it just didn't seem quite right. So I don't know, just whatever lodges in my head, and sometimes it'll stay there for a very long time before I make use of it, which is what we were saying in the beginning about how the book came to me in very, very gradual stages.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Do you mind if I read a little something from the book before I ask my next question?
No, go on. Go ahead.
Okay. So this is a scene that takes place in the Carmen, Alice, and Nick's father's apartment. And I just wanted to read a little bit of the descriptions. The apartment, which occupied the floor above her father's studio, was pure 60s bohemian, beatnik through and through, Danish modern furniture, blonde and webbed, sagging brick and board bookcases, a set of bongos gathering dust in the corner, primitive African art on the walls, along, of course, with Horace's paintings. The apartments of all her parents' old town crowd bore a similar stamp. These were the lairs of old artists and their younger trophy muses, women who were themselves now creeping through late middle age, variously thinning down or plumping up dramatically. I'm just going to stop there because it goes on, and I don't want to take too much time or read too much of it, but it was so wonderful. And that, I felt this way in a lot of scenes in the book, but I wanted to talk a little bit about setting and detail and how you do that so well. Do you just sit at your desk and envision a scene and this stuff comes to you, or are you taking notes all the time about, oh, okay, so this is a room that's a really cool room to, I want to write about this and take notes. How do you come up with all that detail? And
well, here with a number of passes is how I do it. My first pass at any scene, I can only get the roughest stuff down, you know, like they're inside and, you know, there's three people. But then as I keep going back at it, I can add to it. I mean, all my writing, 90% of my writing is revising, I would say. And nice. When I tell my students, go back, keep going back to this, because most often with student work, it's neither good nor bad as it's a standard quality, as it's thin. And I think there are times when I think what I do with scene is some kind of bad craft hobby, or like those Romanian Easter eggs, you know, that they're made of sugar and you look inside, yeah, and there's a room of the palace inside the egg and who cares? But, I have to do it that way. I really like to be able to see the scene, and I'm so pleased when readers come away and say, I really could imagine, I mean, I really saw that room, or I really felt, you know, that experience of being in that steam bath or whatever. I want to take them there.
Right. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about revision. 90% of your writing is revision. Is that what you said, sort of?
Could be 92%.
Do you write a full first draft?
No, I keep writing, and I don't always write sequentially either. I write what I can. I'm on a new book now, and there's scenes I can write. They're the only scenes I can write right now, and those scenes will indicate to me what other scenes need to be written.
Okay.
And I don't want to write any scenes unless they really need to be there. You know, the movies have freed us up, fiction writers, from the carriage ride. You know, we don't have to have the carriage ride anymore between the house and the ball. You know, you just jump to the ball.
Right, right, yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, so when you finally, let's say, have a full draft of a story, will you have already revised it by that, you know, not 90%, but, I mean, a good part of your revision is finished by the time you get to a full first draft?
Yes.
Okay.
But then maybe 50%.
Okay.
Then I got to go back over everything.
All right.
I have to go over everything a number of times. Okay. This book took me like 6 or 7 years to write. I mean, it's slow work. But I don't know. I think there's too many books and not enough of them are good enough.
Uh-huh.
So I think it would benefit everybody to slow down a little bit.
Yeah. So you just mentioned that you're working on a new book. Can you talk a little bit about what that is or not yet?
Not yet. It's very dark. Let me put it that way. It's very dark. Maybe I'm getting darker.
Is it a novel?
Yeah,
it's
a novel, yeah.
Okay.
And I have a story, too, coming out in Best American in the fall.
Oh,
that
good.
That is the best story I've ever written. And so I was really happy when they picked it.
That's awesome.
Because now lots of people will get to see my best story.
Where did it publish? Where was it published?
It was in New Ohio Review. And they're really nice people there. But I don't think their readership is giant. And so it was going to, and they don't have too much of a web presence, although they've given me a microphone here that I'm supposed to read the story into, which I keep putting off because I live in a city, so there's a lot of ambient noise, and I don't know when I'm ever going to be able to have stillness to read this story. But I thought, well, so when I got picked for Best American, I thought that's so great, you know, because lots of people will be able to see this story.
Yeah.
And that was a story that it was like it was just like a present. It just arrived. I opened it up. I put it on the page. There it was.
That's amazing.
It doesn't happen very often.
It must be such a pleasure that, you know, they're publishing it, brought it to, you know, Best American's attention, and that you're writing it brings the New Ohio Review to people's attention too, which is kind of neat.
Yes. Because I don't think they've had a story that made it there yet, and it's a really cool journal. But I don't know what's going to happen with journals. I also had a part of the book put on Granta Online. I wonder how many readers read it on Granta Online as opposed to how many readers read the story in New Ohio Review, or if the websites shift the material. You know, they can add infinite new material, but I don't know how long your story is up there for. Whereas in a journal, it's there on somebody's coffee table, and they might pick it up 6 months later and read it.
Yeah.
So, you know, pluses and minuses on both.
So, Carol, who are a few of your favorite writers of fiction?
Well, I'm actually prepared to answer this, although usually it's the question that I stumble over, but a couple of people have asked me along the way, and I guess I would say the three writers who have been most important in my work are Shirley Hazzard, Don DeLillo, and Alice Munro.
Oh, wow.
For different reasons.
And so different, yeah. That's great. Okay, that's really interesting.
They're all high style writers. You know, I mean, that's my favorite kind of book, is where the style is just luscious.
Mm-hmm.
And they all use style in a different way, but they're, in addition to being great minds, they're also wicked craftspeople. You know, they can make a sentence that just does everything perfect.
You won a National Book Critics Circle citation for book reviewing. So can you talk a little bit about book reviewing? And you have mentioned to me earlier before the interview that you don't actually do it anymore. So I wonder if we can talk about that too.
Yeah, I did it for a really long time. And the book reviewing I did led me then to do literary essays for VLS, the Village Voice Literary Supplement. And that was really, as much as Vermont, that was my graduate school in writing, because there was a great editor then, M. Mark, and she, you know, an edit for a piece on The Voice would be four or five edits, and, you know, some of them lasting 3 hours long on the phone, because I live here in Chicago, not in the Village. And I really learned about organization of idea, of having a thesis, a through line, and you know, just was really, really instructive to me. But by the time I'd done it for, I think I did it for 8 years or so, and behind that I'd done a lot of reviewing for like the Trib and the Sun-Times here, and I don't know, it just became a lot of time adhered to the work of other people. And then it had the additional peril for me as a novelist myself of sometimes being in the very unpleasant circumstance of having to negatively review a book by another writer, and they never meant for their book to be awful, and they're probably very nice people, but you have to, your responsibility is to the book and the reader of the review, I think. So I just thought, I don't know, you know, there's probably people who will throw a drink at me or something at a party and someday, and I don't want there to be very many of those people. And so I thought, and I had just done it, you know, most reviews are either, you know, 800 or 1,000 words. That's a very little, and I could see in some of the reviews of my book, I could tell that the reviewer was suffering from constraints more than, because there's a lot of plot lines in my book, and you know, not able to address all of them, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I had done it. I had done a lot of it, and I felt like I had done enough. And it also takes up a ton of your reading time, and you're reading not what you want to read, but I always say reviewers have this whole body of fiction that they can only talk about with other reviewers because none of their friends have read these books. They're kind of like the second shelf books, but yeah. Somebody felt they needed to be reviewed. And we've all read them, but you haven't.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be reading second shelf books. I'm not going to be able to read 1/100th of all the great books. So, I didn't want my reading time absorbed with that. And then, you know, the other thing that's entered my life in the past maybe 15 years is painting, which is, I shouldn't say this, but I really devote almost as much time to painting as to writing.
Now, why shouldn't you say that?
I don't know. It's just such a guilty pleasure. I'm always crawling up there to that studio and, you know, what am I thinking? But I'm doing this big series of paintings now. I've got about 10 done, and I think I'll have about 15 when I'm done, which is kind of painting the life of Vita Sackville-West. Do you know who she is?
No, I don't.
Well, there's the reason for my show. She was this really kind of mediocre novelist. She was born in 1892, so she was, you know, writing through the 20s and 30s and 40s. And she was an aristocrat, and she was one of those kind of Tom and Daisy Buchanan kind of people, very, pick people up and then crumple them up and toss them away. And she seduced a ton of women in the British middle, upper, and upper classes, including Virginia Woolf. She was a great love of Virginia Woolf. And, she couldn't just go to a bar and pick up these babes. You know, she had to drag them by the roots out of their marriages and make a lot of trouble for everybody and, you know, seduce and abandon them. And then she was married to a guy who was queer, too, they bought a ruined castle and renovated it. And they put in this big garden, so she's now maybe more well known as a gardener than as a writer. And you can go and visit it at her castle. So,
say her name one more time.
Her name is Vita Sackville-West, two words hyphenated. And she's this really terrible person, and there were so many interesting things about her to paint. And I figure not a lot of people know about her. And I wanted to do something with her, and I hate anything that's bio novel or, you know what I mean, or
right.
Biopics, you know. It's like, I just can't, because anytime like Kennedy, the phone rings, you know it's going to be the Bay of Pigs. It's never like his dry cleaning is ready. Do you know what I mean? It's all. So I figure, well, I'll just paint her. So I don't know if she'll appreciate it. And then some of the paintings, I paint myself into them, you know, like a tea party.
I should
have been there. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's great. I love it.
Yeah.
So I wondered if there's a certain point when you're writing a novel that trips you up or that's most difficult for you? Is it the middle of the book, or is it as you close in on what you consider to be, you know, finishing up? Is there anything like that?
No, it's never by where it would occur in the book. It's, for instance, here's a for instance with this book. I actually, you know, Alice makes these paintings, and she knows she's not going to show them. And her first impulse is that they have to be destroyed. But I really agonized, and I'm not going to say on the interview, whether she would destroy all that work, which she knew was her best work, because she didn't want to, you know, gain any celebrity out of her attachment to the girl. I thought I wrote it one way, wrote it another way, showed it to my partner, showed it to my friend. You should do this. And so, and finally I decided, but really I had to write it out several ways before I figured out a way to do it.
And then were you pleased with it?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right.
Yeah, good. Great.
And some parts of the book come so easy, and other parts are such a struggle. And that never shows, hopefully, with the finished product. You can't think, because I'm having this much trouble with this, this stinks. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm trying to make it, you know, not smell as bad as it does. It's not that. It's just that, I don't know, maybe some things. Remember I told you that that story that's going to be in The Best American just came to me whole cloth?
Yes, like
kind
a gift.
Of?
Yes.
Yes, and that almost never happens. But it does occasionally. They ask me to write something for the back of the book. And all I can think of is with those kinds of things, that piece has been sitting rumbling around in the back of my mind until it was ready, and then I just transcribed it. And that doesn't happen. Sometimes I have to do all of that work consciously.
Yeah. Now, apart from whether, you know, beginning, middle, or end of the actual novel, do you find that in working on a novel, the beginning of your process is easier because maybe you're energized with this new idea, or is that not the case?
No. That's the horrible part.
But how do you feel about this?
I'd have to say no, because it's just like all your characters are claymation figures, you know, uttering, you know, the most baldly stated words, and you have to keep going, you know, like it's like the Romanian Easter egg. I had to keep going back in there and putting, you know, this and bettering that, and that's the part that's really fun for me. But the you know, slapping something down on the blank page, oh, my God, it's horrifying.
That's so funny. Okay, well, I have one last question for you, and that is, and we are talking about it already a little bit, but for writers that might be listening, do you have any advice about how to, you know, work into that revision and know, you know, no, this still isn't right, and I need to work on this more, or I need to figure out what Alice is going to do with her paintings? Do you have any advice for people about how to kind of approach that process?
Well, I think with a novel, they can, you know, you're always working on one thing or another, and you can let a section rest a little bit and then go back to it. I just think to keep going back to sections that feel a little thin or that feel a little false, or not false maybe, but contrived, and sand them, you know, so that they're smooth, and then sand the transitions. I built little visual or oral or olfactory links between every section in Carry the One. And I don't expect you to have noticed them, but if you went and looked for them now, you could find them. And the reason I did that was I'm jumping about a year ahead with every section and switching characters and points of view and all that. So I wanted something that would attach to the reader's subconscious in terms of linkage. So... yeah, then I put those in.
Neat. Okay. Was that something that you have done in other books, or is it just something that sort of occurred as you were writing that would help hold this together? Because this is a book in multiple narrative viewpoints. And
yeah, I thought it would help. I thought it would be cool.
I really enjoyed the book, Carry the One by Carol Ann Shaw, published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much, Carol, for speaking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Carol Ann Shaw. You can read more about her work and see some of her paintings also at her website, carolannshaw.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Carol Ann Shaw, who uses this prompt in her classes in the MFA in Writing program at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. The prompt actually started from an exercise that she found in the book What If? By Anne Bernays and Pamela Painter. Although Carol uses a slightly altered version of her own take on this exercise. So here's what she does. Take an event that happened in your life between the ages of 5 and 11, when you were between the ages of 5 and 11. Write a list comprised of everything you can remember about the incident. And then make a second list and include in it everything that you don't remember. And then write a story using that second list. So you're going to write a story that's made up entirely of all the things you don't remember about an important event that happened between the time you were 5 and 11 years old. The exercise, Carol says, is particularly useful for new writers who afterward might better understand the process of creating fiction. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please navigate to Facebook's Write the Book radio show page and like us. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. If you go to theradiator.org, you get to the homepage, and then you'll see there's a place where you can click to listen to the broadcast. Archived episodes of the show are available on iTunes. and at the website writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you go to the website, it's set up like a blog. You just scroll down and you'll see all the shows in reverse chronological order, and you can either download them or click on the little play button to listen to each one. If you have comments about the show, or if you want to send news about a book-related event, if you're hosting a reading or something, or you are an author who's going to be reading somewhere, please feel free to send an email my way to writethebook@gmail.com. If you have a writing prompt to suggest, you can send an email as well, or any suggestions about the show or requests that I try to get in touch with a favorite author of yours who you'd like to hear interviewed. The email again is writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. All of the work that is being done at The Radiator is done by volunteers. And more information about getting involved is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Thank you.